Call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 5th, 2018. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Bishop, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Senator Stedman, and myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Meyer to be showing up shortly. Excused today are Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Wilikowski. Thanks to Ann and Max, who are helping us out today, recording the minutes and helping us with the audio. So today the committee has one item on its agenda, and that's an overview of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. Welcome, Senator Meyer.
Thank you.
Created in 1970, Alaska's park system consists of 128 park units and over 3 million acres of land and water, far and away the largest state park system anywhere in the United States. The park system traces its roots back to the famed aviator Charles Lindbergh's speech to the state legislature in 1968 advocating for a state conservation and recreation system, and it was constituted into law with the sponsorship of the late Lowell Thomas Jr., who was then a member of this body. Underpinning the drive for the park system was the need for the state to control its lands. By designating lands like the Wood Tick-Chick State Park, the state preempted federal designation that would have resulted in more centralized, restrictive management from Washington. Access to average Alaskans without incurring financial hardship is a mission of the Parks Division, but so is financial sustainability. In recent years, the Park Division has overseen a program to mitigate its funding to eventually subsist on user fees. We also gave them jurisdiction to create logo gear, which I'm interested to hear how that's going. So we welcome before the committee today our new Parks Division Director, Mr. Ethan Tyler. He's joined by the Deputy Commissioner of DNR, Heidi Hansen. So welcome. If you'd identify yourselves for the record, we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. Heidi Hansen, Deputy Commissioner, DNR.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ethan Tyler, Division Director, Division of State Parks and Outdoor Recreation. And thank you for that lovely background to kick us off. I even learned a couple of things in there. Well, to get started, I always like to use the marketing adage that we tell you what we're going to talk about and talk about it and then recap what we've talked about. So to get us started, we'll run through the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation's primary sections. There are a couple of things that are in there that some people don't always know. We'll go through most of our regions and highlighting a couple of regions with some specific points of interest, and then that will kind of meld with FY17 highlights and our direction moving forward. And so just a quick background about myself, if I may. I'm new to the Division of State Parks, previously with the Division of Economic Development. Took on the role of State Parks Director in July of this year, so I'm a little over 6 months on the job, and we're rolling along, and I think we've got some exciting things to share with you today. So thank you for having us. So one of the sections that most people are not aware lives within the Division of State Parks and Outdoor Recreation is the Office of History and Archaeology. And so this serves as the state's historic preservation agency. We work very closely with the federal government, and the state historic preservation officer is the lead in that section. They maintain a statewide inventory of cultural resources and serve as the state liaison to federal agencies in such issues with the National Register of Historic Places. We work with the National Park Service and the Department of Interior quite a bit. Another thing that I would mention about the Office of History and Archaeology is that from a development standpoint, we work very closely with a number of development projects in the state to identify cultural resources and heritage areas, and to ensure, to put it simply, in some of these bigger projects, to ensure that when someone puts a shovel in the ground, they're not disturbing a historical site and making sure that they're in compliance with federal permits and the like, having to do with history. So some of our economic some of our big economic projects and economic drivers, there's always a little bit of the Office of History and Archaeology behind those as well.
So, Director Tyler, does that mean you work with, for example, the gas pipeline project?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is SHPO, right?
Correct.
So every miner that gets an annual APMA has to get blessed by SHPO, too, and they get a letter.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, was AMPA?
Annual Placer Mining Application.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of my favorite and the most fun and some of the most visible things that we do come through the Office of Boating Safety. And this year was really exciting this fall, actually, and I was able to participate in this. It was the 10,000th Kids Don't Float participant in that program. So that program consists of classroom activities. It consists of in-water activities. I don't know if you've ever seen it or not, but there are some great exercises that they do with kids in a pool, and they bring out a canoe, and they put all these kids in the canoe, and then they overload the canoe, and the canoe sinks in the pool. And even though they're in a warm pool and they have these great life jackets on, the look on their faces when that boat fails and sinks out from underneath them is pretty priceless, and I think really teaches a solid lesson. A couple of highlights from that this year, our staff member Kelly Toth received a very prestigious award, the National Boating Safety Educator of the Year Award, which comes from the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators. And so that's a national award that she received. We also received a partnership award for our work on what's called the Float Coat Song, which was done in conjunction with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. The person who actually started the Office of Boating Safety back under the Murkowski administration, Jeff Johnson, who is retiring from that section, I'm sad to say, this spring, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame of that same organization. So it was a busy year with the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators this year. No, I'm sorry.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to ask, is this program funded by the boat receipts? Is that
Senator Meyer, through the chair, yes, it is partly funded by the boating receipts. We utilize boating receipts for match to the federal funds that come in, along with any projects that we do within the parks, like a boat ramp or anything that has to do with boats. We are able to utilize as match for that program for our federal funds that we get. It's primarily federally funded, but yes.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, if I may?
Yes, follow up, Senator Meyer.
So this program started in early 2000, I guess, you said, under Murkowski administration?
Correct.
Okay. And you've had 10,000 kids go through the program already?
Well, Senator Meyer, through the chair, that's actually the Kids Don't Float officially, Kids Don't Float program officially got kicked off around 2012. So it's been 10,000 kids since 2012.
Wow.
Follow-up, Senator Meyer?
Well, I think that's great. It's just that I hadn't heard of the program in Anchorage, so I don't know, how do kids find out about this?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, that is, we work very closely with the school districts throughout the state.
Okay.
All through the state, we have contacts at the school districts that we work with to get us in front of that number of kids.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could follow
yes.
up? So do the commercial fishermen use this program, too, for some of their work crew?
Good question, through the chair, Senator Meyer. There is a nonprofit organization here in Juneau, and the name escapes me off the top of my head, that does a lot of the commercial fishing training. I don't know the exact math of that. We're able to use some of those dollars for match, for the federal match as well. But we do some commercial. We work a lot with the Coast Guard, but there is an organization here in Juneau that does a lot of the commercial vessel training.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sure that many of you are, I hope that many of you are familiar with the Kids Don't Float life jackets. There are the pavilions at almost every boat launch in the state that have, you know, borrow life jacket setups there. And recorded, at least 33 Alaskan lives have been saved by utilizing those life jackets. And those aren't all kids' lives that have been saved, where sometimes an adult will be climbing into their boat and they don't have a life jacket, and they'll grab a couple of kids' ones just because they're there. And we've had instances where that's been the case, and an adult life has been saved through those kiosks as well.
Wow.
So it's a very effective program. And then into the bulk of Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, which is our field operations. So field operations, those are the folks that you see out in the field, primarily our ranger staff and our natural resource technician staff, maintenance folks that are out in the field. So we work with, around the state, we work with 12 local citizens advisory boards that provide public input on how to best manage our parks. You know, that staff that's out in the field ensures that Alaska State Parks are providing the high-quality experience that people come to expect, and sustainable park facilities. Like I mentioned, there's a lot of maintenance staff included in that group. And we're an important partner with the state's visitor industry. A number of folks in the visitor industry utilize state parks as part of their tour package offerings and the like. And we'll get to that. I have a couple of slides regarding that a little bit later on as well.
Senator Coghill.
So, whenever this comes up, I like to relay to you that many of us are very grateful for the advisory groups. They're an actual really good arm to get volunteer work because they seem to double themselves wherever they go. And you just need to be able to relay to them when it's your turn to talk to them that many of us in the legislature are very grateful for their work because they do a lot of footwork for you that wouldn't otherwise get done.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, thank you very much. We're proud to work with those volunteers, and they do provide really critical input and support to the park system, so thank you. and then just to note, the park fees that we brought in last year covered approximately 51% of the operation costs in FY17. And we'll get to a little bit more of that as well, but yeah, I thought you might want to chat about that a little. So just a quick overview, and as Senator Giesel mentioned at the beginning, the largest state park system in the country, also home to the largest state park in the country, which is Wood-Tikchik State Park, and also home to the fourth largest state park in the country, which is Chugach State Park. But our park system is divided up into six primary regions, 3.3 million acres, and last year we saw approximately 3.6 million visitors to the park system. So just a couple of regional points of interest. I mentioned at 495,000 acres, Chugach State Park is the fourth largest in the U.S., because of its proximity to Anchorage, we see a lot of high use areas. So that's one of the challenges that we work with is making sure that the facilities exist for that high level of use, but also rerouting traffic when or attempting to reroute where people are going to mitigate some of those high use areas and to encourage people into other areas of the park. It may come as no surprise to our senators from the Anchorage area that the number one viewed web page on the state parks web page is the Glen Alps parking lot cam, because before people go up there, they check on the parking situation to make sure that there's a spot for them. So the most viewed site on our site, most viewed page on our site. in keeping with the theme of winning awards, our park specialist Joe Hall was awarded a partnership award this year from the nonprofit organization Alaska Geographic. Joe has been really instrumental in building partnerships with some of our nonprofit partners and supporters in the state park system, and he's gotten a couple of really, really great trail projects completed because he's been able to work with some of these other organizations, get some additional funding to put some work into the trails in his area. So so hats off to Joe for that. And then something that is little known as well is that Wood-Tikchik State Park actually falls, the management for that falls under the Chugach region. So the Chugach superintendent oversees Wood-Tikchik State Park. And we do have ranger staff out in Wood-Tikchik, but the superintendent oversees that from Chugach. That's a duplicate. There we go. touching on the Kenai region is really one of our most diverse park areas in the state. It includes numerous marine parks in Prince William Sound, land-based areas out of Valdez, like many of you may be familiar with Worthington Glacier, a popular stop for motor coaches and visitors that are going through the Valdez area. Kachemak Bay State Park in Homer, Cane's Head State Recreation Area in Seward, and of course the centerpiece of the Kenai region, the Kenai River Special Management Area, which is also another very high use area for the park system.
Director Tyler, a question. So when I think of the Kenai, I think of also some federal areas, either parks or wildlife. How many of our state parks abut federal lands or federal parks as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We work in conjunction with our federal partners a lot. Mm-hmm. And just off the top of my head, I could think of 10 really relevant areas in which we work with our federal partners. I don't have a number off the top of my head, but I would tell you that a lot of our state park areas abut federal partner areas. Just a couple of quick examples. Prince William Sound, a lot of our state marine parks abut Chugach National Forest. Chugach State Park abuts Chugach National Forest. Denali State Park and Denali National Park. Your example of the Kenai is, it's the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge that is Skelak Lake there, and then the Kenai River Special Management Area starts coming out of from Skelak Lake there. So we work really hand in hand with our federal partners. We also have some cooperative agreements with them. An example in Denali State Park, we have an agreement with the National Park Service where they provide interpretive services with one of their rangers at the new Kasugi Ken campground in Denali State Park. So we have a really solid working relationship with our federal partners, to be sure.
Good.
Our northern area, is, of course, based out of Fairbanks. The superintendent is out of Fairbanks there. A couple of highlights, and this is kind of where we're starting to mix some area regional points of interest with moving forward and FY17 things. But Allness Pond, a popular camping and ATV area outside of Fairbanks, received funding through our state trails program for significant ATV trail improvements this last year. That's a federal grant program that Division of Parks administers. Necessary repairs were made to stabilize the river area, riverbank area along Big Delta State Historic Park. We talked a little bit about park sustainability. Fairbanks area parks increased their fee areas, which are just places that they're able to charge fees or do charge fees for parking or whatnot. Increased those from 5 in 2015. To 25 currently, and that just came from, there were just areas that we could have been charging fees previously but weren't, or they needed a small amenity to be able to charge a parking fee for that area, and so we worked with the Community Advisory Board, of course, but worked hand-in-hand with them and with the community to identify some of those areas where we could bring in more revenue for the Fairbanks area. And that has worked. It's in process, so I don't have great numbers off the top of my head, but we have seen an increase in revenue, and my expectation is that we'll continue to see increased revenue out of the northern area. As a cost-saving measure, Delta area parks were put into passive management last year, and we worked with the community in Delta, and there was an interim period where there was no management of those park areas, but the community members in Delta came together and volunteered to keep those areas open. They're very passionate about their parks in Delta. And they were able to keep those areas open by volunteering for outhouse cleaning and trash removal and really boots on the ground. So hats off to the folks in Delta for that. After we were able to go through the procurement process, we issued permits to private sector companies to operate those parks. And so the way that works is the Division of Parks issues them a permit. And with that permit, they have the authority to operate those park areas and collect the fees. And so we had some private sector businesses step up and take that on. Last May was the opening of the Kasugi Ken Campground in Denali State Park, and that's part of our Mat-Su region. It's really the crown jewel of campgrounds for the state park system. It has 32 new RV tent campsites, all with electric hookups, which none of our state parks, actually the one in Chena River State Rec area, has electric as well. But those are the only two in the system that have electricity. There are 10 walk-in campsites, 3 public use cabins, and an interpretive pavilion, and I mentioned the partnership with the National Park Service. We really have close partnerships with the visitor industry, stakeholders, large and small, around Denali State Park and this new area that came online last year. Everything from small businesses that provide hiking guides for the area trails, all the way up to the large land tour companies and the big motor coaches that you see on the road that bring visitors to the area to experience the view and the interpretive area up there and the amenities. So it's been a real success, and we're really just getting started with it. It opened in May, and so we don't have really a full year of what it looks like, but so far it's incredibly popular both winter and summer, and I can speak from personal experience. I've tried a number of times to book a public use cabin there and haven't been able to get on there in time in order to secure that, so very popular. So again, moving into where we're going and some of the things that we're doing, we began charging historic access fees at Independence Mine State Historic Park and Totem Bight State Historic Park last year. We don't charge access fees to our parks. As you mentioned, part of the mission is to provide these areas and this land resource for the people of Alaska. So we don't charge entrance fees into the parks specifically, but when we have a state historic site, we are able to charge a historic access fee for those. And so we did implement those as a revenue measure last year at both Independence Mine and Totem Bight. And they're incredibly popular areas, and we did not receive a lot of pushback on those fees. People understood that they were going towards park sustainability for the most part, and we saw good success with that. And a couple of things to note about are a couple of these park areas. Independence Mine is rated the number one visitor attraction in Wasilla on TripAdvisor. And then Totem Bight is rated the number 4 attraction in Ketchikan, but don't let that fool you, because the top three are Misty Fjords National Monument, fishing charters and tours, and nature and wildlife tours. So no specific site or company, but so I consider that's number one. I'm biased. And we did see a number, just some visitor numbers there, 43,000 at Independence Mine State Historic Park and 45,000 at Totem Bight State Historic Park.
Director Tyler, you know, Independence Mine area is really popular for skiing, and I've heard talk about a ski resort there. Is any of that real? It certainly would have to be on private land, wouldn't it?
Yes, Madam Chair, there are plans for a ski area in the Hatcher Pass area. My understanding is that that is on municipal land in the Hatcher Pass area.
Mm-hmm.
And they did receive a significant boost to their finances this year from a grant. And so I think that they're moving forward with that project more than they have in the past even.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so coming from the Division of Economic Development, I can't do a presentation without mentioning the impact that parks have on as economic drivers in the state. So just a couple of points here. 626 commercial use permits were issued in 2017. With my visitor industry and business development background, my goal is to get that number to increase and to have more partnerships with some of our visitor industry partners. But those 626 commercial use permits really represent businesses on the ground that are working within our parks. So those are fishing guides, tour guide companies, water taxis, motor coach and van tours, hiking guides, and the like. So there's a really diverse array of people who utilize our park areas for business. I mentioned visitor industry partnerships and working at growing those. You may have heard adventure travel is an up-and-coming trend in the visitor industry. My hope is that we can work with our visitor industry partners and capitalize on that growing trend of adventure travel.
So, Director Tyler, are there any industrial uses that go on in our parks?
Excellent question, Madam Chair. Off the top of my head, I don't think so. But I'll look at that and get back to you if that's okay.
Sure. Thank you.
Every park is different based on the statute that's enabling legislation. And so some have compatible uses are different than others in different areas. And they also abide by a management plan that's written according to the enabling statutes. But off the top of my head, I don't think so. But I will follow up. So I mentioned public use cabins. This is a picture of the new public use cabin in Denali State Park, one of three. We moved the online reservation system to a different company last year, and so it's a no-cost contract to the state. They do take a fee as part of the reservation process, but it really just allowed much easier booking for our guests and our visitors, and also much easier tracking for us. And payment options made it easier for someone to move a reservation or cancel a reservation, and it's outlined quite clearly as to when you can get a refund and when you can't, whereas before it was a little harder to understand and harder to get your refund or move your reservation. So this is working well so far. My hope is to put a couple of our busier campgrounds online as well moving forward. But another thing, our public use cabins are incredibly popular, as I mentioned. I know a number of people who identify the weekend they want a state public use cabin, and they set their alarm for midnight 7 months out so that they can get up and get online and make that booking and be the first one to get there. So in some of our cabins, we have peak occupancy that exceeds 85%. I know hotels that would be pretty happy with an 85% occupancy rate. And public use cabins are excellent investments for our park system. Not only is there a demonstrated demand for public use cabins, but they require minimal maintenance, and the investment that you make in that public use cabin is paid off depending on, you know, what the rate is and the occupancy and a couple of other factors, but anywhere from 3 to 5 years that is paid off and then becomes a revenue stream, strictly a revenue stream to the division.
Senator Coghill.
I can attest to the fact that they're popular because if you want one as a getaway, you have to be almost 2 years out to think about it. So in some areas, I think I tried to get in the Prince William Sound one, and I couldn't do it. So that keeps me alert to the fact that they are hugely popular. But because they're hugely popular, do we consider adding more along the way? Because there are, not that I'd ever want to do it on a whim, but if I can't get one in March for September, that means they're pretty popular. So have you thought about adding more? I think the Prince William Sound is one kind of traffic that you could probably regulate a little better because you have to get there by boat. But I can tell you it's very difficult for those of us who live here to get in on those cabins.
Yeah, Senator Coghill, through the chair, thank you. Yes, we actually have a capital request this year to build 5 additional cabins, and strategically locating those. We haven't picked exactly where they would be if that goes through, but if that does go through, strategically locating those so that they're in areas that see high demand, and that their accessibility is such that they would have a quick payoff time for the division.
Good. Follow up, Senator Coghill.
I just know some of them are seasonal, so you have to consider that. But up in my neck of the woods, in the northern region, they're all year round use. So putting my vote in.
Senator Stedman.
I'm just kind of curious on the rates, you know, the nightly rates on these personal use cabins. It seems that if there's that much demand, it might be a rate structure issue also. And I'd have it just seems like an awful quick payback, 3 to 5 years. And so are you including replacement reserves and maintenance and all the other fun stuff that has to go into maintaining and administrating the cabins?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, thank you. the 3 to 5 years is it does not include the maintenance costs that go along with that. Although I would say that I did run through the maintenance costs of these cabins, and they are it still fits within that 3 to 5 years. The maintenance costs are so minimal on a year-to-year basis. And I'm sorry, what was your other rate structure? So that is one of the things that I am looking at currently, is the rate structure of the cabins. Previously, most of those rates have been set by the different regions, and some of them you pay about the same amount for a cabin in one region, or you pay one amount for a cabin in one region and a lower amount in another region. And so bringing those to where they're consistent across the system, potentially raising some of the rates at some of the more popular areas, certainly to capitalize on volume there and popularity. And the other side of that is also true, that we have some cabins that could potentially benefit from some more dynamic pricing, where there are never full midweek, and so if you offered a potentially lower rate on some of those midweek rates, you could bump your occupancy up and bring in more revenue by doing that. So kind of like a hotel model, where you capitalize on where your strong points are and then work with your weaker points to just keep bumping that occupancy up. I have a hotel background, so that's always in the back of my mind.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, just a follow-up. Just kind of, we're talking about revenues, and I know you're new to the job and all that, and you've got all these parks around you got to come up to speed with, but
In Sitka, we have a boat ramp and a Stargavin boat ramp. But it, you know, when we went through this beginning of this evolution here at the parks, concern was revenue. And apparently there was, or let me back up a little bit. So the what would the structure would be, you could go down to the harbor master, buy a year pass for your boat trailer, and go out and use it, or pay $5 or, you know, a launch, and then put a little card in the window, and they had a little cash box for the, you know, the $5 guy, and it would and then they'd split the money. They have some city boat ramps in Sitka, so they split it, I think 50-50 or whatever, between the city and the state, which was seemed to be working fine. And then we had our issue, fiscal issue coming up that we're dealing with, and apparently there wasn't the ability to have somebody from the state empty the cash box. So not only did they not empty the cash box, they took the cash box off the post. So now you go out there and you use it for free, which is fine in certain regards, but there wasn't the fee structure would help with lights and snow plowing and the maintenance, because it's also used as an emergency response location. Obviously, it's dark in the winter in Alaska a lot, and we have issues even when it's dark, so you have to get people up and down the dock safely. And my concern, of course, was lack of maintenance and the bewilderment of the inability to empty the cash box, not finding somebody to go get the dough. So I'd, you know, when you have time in your busy schedule, if you could come up with some mechanism to collect the cash box, we could put the cash box back on the post and get the folks to pay their $100 fee a year, or their $5. And I think it was probably, I want to say $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, something like that, for the state's cut a year, which covers quite a bit of snow plowing and quite a bit of lights and other things. So not that I, you know, want my friends to give me a hard time about now having to pay for the boat ramp. It's a very nice boat ramp paid for by the state. And the fee was reasonable. And I would just like to encourage you, when you go around with your business model and you look at your facilities, the other area that you're sitting on that I think is attractive is Castle Hill, or in Sitka, where the Russians and the Americans lowered the flag, one flag, and hoisted up the other one. So there's got to be some mechanism, much like Totem Bight. You know, 45,000 people, there's 1 million visitors coming to Ketchikan, roughly. So it's a pretty low percentage, but it's very helpful to Totem Bight, and hopefully that percentage penetration comes up. Sitka has about 10% of that number. Maybe we're probably pushing 20% of that number now, somewhere in that range. So we got a lot lower amount of people, but it's right downtown. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be some way we can generate some revenue from the parks to help maintain them. Yes. I just, you know, like to just ask you to look at that at some point, because your predecessor about gave me a coronary when told me we couldn't find anybody to go empty the cash box. Most guys have trouble getting people to put money in the cash box. Emptying it is normally a pretty easy part of the job.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I have been briefed on the scenario in Sitka, and it is something that we're looking at. Any number of the items that you brought up are definitely on my list. So, yeah. And I'm happy to discuss that with you further at another time, too.
This is a popular topic. Senator Bishop has a question also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These cabins, traditionally, they're dry cabins.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop.
No electricity.
Yes, correct.
Outhouse. Bring your own bedroll and your foam pad, right?
Correct.
So they're pretty low maintenance cabins. Okay. Thank you.
So, Director Tyler, I had a question. Last year, hot topic was the Kisilov boat launch. What's going on there right now?
Madam Chair, the Kisilov boat launch last year, with the transition from my predecessor to me and the time that was between those, was put on hold. And I have taken it back up and have been engaging with the residents in the Kisilov area, working on some redesign ideas for that, and we are moving that project forward.
Great. So. Thank you for that information.
Thank you.
Good. I don't see any more questions on this slide.
Great. And so, wrapping up a bit here, but with a topic that's been interwoven with a lot of the discussions in just about every other slide, is the conversation around park sustainability. And so I mentioned the Fairbanks example, increasing the number. So a couple of thoughts as far as how we plan to increase park sustainability, increase revenue from our park areas, without it creating a burden to the people of Alaska to utilize the areas and the facilities. So I mentioned increased number of fee areas like we did in the Fairbanks area. There was just a case where there were a number of areas that historically had never charged fees. We could charge fees, and so looking at some of those and bringing fee stations to some of those. Along those lines, expanding our electronic fee options is really front and center in my mind is something that we need to work on, and we are working on, where we have electronic payment options, both in our regional offices. If you want to go, it used to be that even just a few years ago, if you wanted to go buy your yearly parking pass for state parks, you came into the regional office and you brought cash or you wrote a check, and that's how you got your parking pass, or you went to REI or any number of other partners. We've set that up to where you can buy those online now. You can buy them in person with credit card, and so that's gotten better over the last few years. You can buy those through our partners and online, but expanding ways to pay for those. Also, for the parking fees, we've all seen those. We call them Iron Rangers. They're the fee boxes, basically, that Senator Stedman was referencing, where, you know, you pull up to your park area and you get out of your car and it's raining and you cumbersomely write your license plate number down and then you look for your $5 bill and then you put it in the fee box. And then on the other side of that, somebody has to take that money out, and then they have to cut the envelopes open, and they have to count all that cash. And so, one of the initiatives that I'm working on is fee stations that utilize a credit card at these parking areas, potentially pay by phone options as well. But just those activities or those additions to infrastructure can raise the fees that are collected at any given area. Voluntary compliance can raise those fees by upwards of 20%. So if you're talking a real high volume area and you're raising your fees by 20% just by capturing people who wanted to pay in the first place, then that's moving in the right direction. I mentioned statewide consistency in our cabin pricing. I also mentioned utilizing our online booking system for some of those higher use campground areas. A lot of those, like the ones with electric specifically, they attract out of state folks with RVs, and those folks want to know where they're camping from night to night. They don't want to show up and be first come first serve and miss out. So we field a lot of calls from people who are asking where they can book their campsites online, and so we're working at moving some of those higher use and longer haul campsites online. We didn't talk much about permitting, but you know, our special use permits and our commercial use permits, we're working at streamlining that permitting process, working on getting something set up online and collecting payment online and easier, just making it easier for people to do business with us. And then increasing partnerships with nonprofit and for-profit organizations around the state that support state parks. REI is a good example. That partnership award that Joe Hall and Chugach State Park received came partly because of his work with REI, building our partnerships with our visitor industry partners, and but also working with the nonprofit sector. We have a number of nonprofits around the state that are friends of groups, so Friends of Ketchikan Bay State Park or Friends of the Chugach State Park, and so working more in lockstep with them and identifying ways that we can partner together to maintain and keep our parks up.
Senator Stedman.
Just as an added comment to the previous discussion on the boat ramps, in no disrespect to my almost law-abiding friends, but having a mechanism where we have to pay the $100 and we get the sticker for the boat trailer. Mm-hmm. To get your sticker for the boat trailer, they want you to bring in the registration, which means the boys have a tendency to come into compliance with the registration rule. Otherwise, they're not so excited about that. So that helped everybody keep the registration up on their trailers. And also, when there is an incident out of the community, when search and rescue or whoever comes in, the police department comes into the parking lot, they know whose trailer is there because they can identify it by the sticker and the number on the sticker and the registration at the harbor department. So there's some safety issues that automatically come into play if you're reported overdue and they want to know if you're back and they don't quite recognize your trailer or what have you. So I would encourage you to work on trying to keep the boat ramps stickered and the boys paying, because it was you noticed more lights on the back of trailers, more license plates on the back of trailers, more compliance, more of the skiffs had their AK number sticker on, so there was a lot of auxiliary benefits.
Thank you, Senator.
Not that my buddies don't all get stickers.
It sounds that way, Senator Sidney. A lot of criminals living in Sitka.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you, Director Tyler, about the logo wear. It was a lengthy discussion and debate about whether to authorize it. What's happening with it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the logo wear, we did print logo wear. We did launch the website that has logo wear on it, and you can get to that from the State Parks website. Depending on the season, we move the button for that. If it's Christmas, it's front and center, and a number of different marketing techniques with that. One thing I will say, though, in my review of that program in coming in, is that we're not in the logo wear business, and there's nobody in state parks that's a retailer, so to speak. And so we do have an inventory of state park wear that my goal is to work with a private sector retailer and move that existing inventory out through an existing retailer. And then step two in that process is to work on some kind of a licensing agreement with a retailer or a clothing manufacturer or whomever that may be, whomever is the best fit for that, or multiple people receive revenue from the licensing of the logo wear, but not have to be involved in it ourselves quite as much. So we have made, I think off the top of my head, $15,000 in revenue from logo wear sales, and they are popular. You do see them around town, but in order to really get the most benefit out of that legislation and that program, I think it requires us to work with a for-profit retailer of some kind that has broader distribution than we do.
Excellent. More expertise also.
Absolutely.
As you said, in retail. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Follow up on Senator Giesel's question. So you have a background in marketing and working with the private sector, so I'm sure you're going to be able to use your talents to help expand and promote that legislation, bring more revenue to the state. And lastly, I'll just say one thing on it, because you got a brand that's ready-made to sell. And just as one example, I think Caterpillar does as good in clothing sales in Europe as they do selling machinery. So you got a brand there that's ripe for the picking, I believe.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I see great potential with it for certain, and I would say stay tuned.
Any other questions for Deputy Commissioner Hansen or Director Tyler? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much for the presentation. Anything further you'd like to add?
I would.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would offer my thanks to the committee for having us here today and for your support of state parks, and hopefully we'll see you out there.
Great. We're looking forward to seeing the new approach that you're bringing to the division. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, that ends our agenda for today. So let me look up when our next meeting is. It will be Wednesday, February 7th. We will hear from the Attorney General at that time. She's going to update us on federal issues. So at this time, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:21 p.m.